And Congress and President Barack Obama right now, as hopefully our Senate gets ready to take some action on climate change, a very timely book out, and I am thrilled to have the author of it on the Green Front today. We'll be speaking in just a moment with Eric Pooley. He is the author of a must-read new book, anyone who's concerned about our climate. And if you're not, well, I'd like to know which planet you have made reservations on, because we all need to be concerned with where our weather is going, our climate. It impacts everything. And if you listen to this program on a regular basis, there's plenty of evidence for that. I pride myself on having connected the dots between what's going on with nature and what we might be doing to impact her positively or negatively for, oh, about a dozen years now. And right now we're pleased to be on the Progressive Radio Network, but for those just finding this program, I was on traditional radio, started out on KCBS Radio doing Green Minutes about 13 years ago, moved to Air America, where we had a weekly interview program with people like Eric Pooley, all the leaders in the forefront of the sustainability movement, and that program eventually worked its way up to daily, only to go down with the network Air America, which went into the red, so Eco Talk faded into the black. But all good things rise from the ashes, at least all necessary things, and I like to think this program, newly named The Green Front, is among those things that just shouldn't go away. So, Eric Pooley, thank you so much for joining me. Eric is the author of the book, The Climate War. He is also the deputy editor of the Bloomberg Business Week report, also a former managing editor of Fortune magazine and chief political correspondent for Time, all of which qualifies him to write this very intriguing insider expose, if you will, on what's going on with our climate and who is playing politics with the planet and who we should hold responsible for doing that. Welcome to the Green Front, Eric.
Thank you, Betsy. It's great to be with you.
So sorry I missed your talk at the San Francisco Commonwealth Club about 10 days ago, but you'll excuse me, I was listening to Al Gore in Nashville as he was talking to about 700 of us about solutions to climate change, which we can talk about.
I was sorry that I couldn't be there with you. I've been trained by Al Gore's Climate Project, and I know how valuable and inspiring it is when you can spend some time with him.
Yes, but you got inside.
And for those who can't, the book has Al Gore is one of the main characters in the book, and I follow him on his climate crusade. And he is a central figure, as you know, in the fight to get serious about climate change in this country, and that's what my book is all about.
And you had unprecedented access to the former vice president and his climate team at the Alliance for Climate Protection. So good for you, because those of us who have made the trek to Mecca, this was my third trip to Nashville, I think, to study with our guru Gore. Up until this particular gathering, he mingled with us a bit, and we, you know, we'd get 1 or 2 minutes with him if we were lucky in the receiving line. But this time he kind of kept a lower profile because of his personal issues, let's just say, so we didn't get a chance to talk with him. But good for you for getting access, because if you can, just tell us, you know, what it was like. He has been in the forefront for so long, for decades.
I started this book, Betsy, in 2007, because I wanted to understand why it was so hard for this country to get serious about climate change. Now, you and your listeners understand the threat, and the environmental activist community understands it. But why do so many other Americans not get it, and why has our political system been unable to take action? Those were the questions that I set out to answer. And I did it by sort of treating this as a war, a public policy war, and embedding with people on all sides of the battleground, with Al Gore, with environmental activists at the Environmental Defense Fund and other organizations, with kids from a grassroots group called Rising Tide, who were chaining themselves to bulldozers to try to keep coal-fired power plants from being built, with politicians and their staff, with coal lobbyists and the people who are trying to confuse the public about what's really happening and what the solutions are. And even with hardcore deniers like Myron Ebell of the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Oh, yes, he's been on my program.
Yeah, who's one of the leaders of the opposition. I wanted to try to tell the story of this battle in novelistic terms. I didn't want to write an environmental manifesto. There are great ones out there. I didn't think we necessarily needed another, or that was where I would contribute. I wanted to explain how the world works, why we're not getting this done, and hopefully inspire people to get involved, because the two missing ingredients here are political leadership and broad public pressure. We have the policy tools to get started. We have the technology to do what we need to do. We just lack the political will, and we're letting the opponents pull the wool over people's eyes, claiming on the one hand that there's no problem, and on the other hand that it would be too expensive to do anything about it. Both of those things are untrue, and I expose the people who are saying them. So it's an expose. It's a political thriller, if you will, kind of a page-turner that's very character-driven, and it's a cliffhanger because it's not over yet, and we need everybody to get involved.
It's so not over yet. It's hanging in the balance right now, you know, in the Senate. And what can you give us any insider scoop on what's happening there?
Sure.
They're doing some horse trading in the back room somewhere.
Exactly. Well, I stopped writing and reporting the book last winter because I wanted it to come out when we got to the next debate. I wanted it to be part of the conversation. And here we are. Over the next 3 weeks or so, the Senate is either going to step up with a bill that includes a mandatory cap on carbon, or it's not. It's already become clear that they're not going to do an economy-wide cap, which is what we need. They might start with a cap just on the utility sector, the power plants.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a good beginning, although woefully inadequate compared to what we need to get. It's the best we're going to do right now, and I'm waiting to see the president step up with a strong, clear, specific call for that bill. He has not yet done that. It's been a disappointment to many in the climate community to see the president really moving forward with what his aides described to me as a stealth strategy, where he doesn't get involved in the details of legislation and doesn't say as much about it as he might publicly. I think that's been a failed strategy, and I hope Barack Obama will abandon it this week.
And what do you attribute that to? Do you think he really would like to be more aggressive and bold on climate legislation, and his handlers are telling him to not go that route? Or do you think the president that we thought was our first green, as well as first black president, was not as green as we had hoped?
Well, I feel that both of those things are true. I didn't expect when I began writing a book called The Climate War that one of those wars would be in the West Wing of the Obama White House, but it did turn out that way. There is a battle going on between the president's environmental advisors and his political advisors, and so far the political advisors have had the upper hand. But I hasten to add that he is the president, and he calls the shots. So it is not fair to point to some underling, even a powerful one like Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel, as the problem. It's up to Barack Obama to lead and to decide the priorities for his administration. Last year, after the Waxman-Markey climate bill passed the House, Obama chose not to bring that bill to the floor of the Senate. He had advisors telling him that the votes weren't there, but it was a catch-22. If he didn't step up, the votes weren't going to be there, and if he did step up, he might be able to bring the votes around on the Senate floor. He chose not to do that. He decided to do health care instead. Here we are a year later, and there's another opportunity, and although Obama, responding to the catastrophic oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, has been coming with some stronger language, when he had an opportunity to address the people of the United States from the Oval Office in prime time, he stopped short, as you know, Betsy, from making a link between the oil spill and the need for a mandatory declining cap on carbon and putting a price on carbon, which everybody agrees, virtually everybody agrees, is the most important first step for accelerating the clean energy economy.
Well, he also stopped short of giving us a green print, if you will, for how to make this big transition, which he called for, this transition from away from fossil fuels and to a cleaner energy future. And that was disappointing when really all we were told to do was pray, which many of us have been doing for a long time, and look where it's gotten us.
Exactly. The time for first principles is past. It's time for specifics now. And the White House only has a week or two to step up with them, or this moment too will slip by like so many other moments have in the past. I know there are Democratic strategists who are telling the White House that this is the wrong time because the midterm elections are approaching. My own view is that the politics have changed thanks to the sea monster at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico spewing 60,000 or more barrels of oil a day. If you look at the polls now, people are ready to take action. They want to be led. They're willing to pay a little bit more to get on a path toward more jobs and clean energy and freedom from foreign oil and freedom from oil spills. It's an opportunity for Barack Obama to step up, and I hope he'll do it.
Now, you wrote a great article called The Rahm After the Storm, focused on Rahm Emanuel's persuading Obama to play it cool. Let's just look at this sort of perfect storm, if you will, for, you know, environmentalists and climate change, activists. This would seem like the perfect storm, if you will, not only with the sea monster gushing, and that's a good way to put it. Anyone who calls it a spill, I correct and say at least call it a kill. It's killing everything in sight, including the whole Gulf economy. Stephen Chu, Carol Browner, Lisa Jackson, unfortunately we lost Van Jones, but this is a dream green, cabinet here of environmental, advisors. And Rahm Emanuel, if we can just stop for a moment, I mean, he is the brother of Ari Emanuel, and I have been covering this beat long enough to remember that Ari Emanuel, along with Arianna Huffington and Lori David, started a campaign in 2002 or 3 called the Detroit Project, which was about, trying to get Americans to give up their gas-guzzling SUVs. I was very aware of that because I launched a mother's campaign on the same topic around the same time called Don't Be Fueled, a grassroots campaign for hybrids, not Hummers. So Ari and Rahm presumably talk. Lori, might have some persuasion abilities there. It would seem like this shouldn't happen. If personal politics and connections really do make a difference.
Well, I think they do make a difference. I think the problem is that Rahm Emanuel sees his job as preserving Obama's political capital over an 8-year arc, and he's focused right now on trying to get as many Democrats elected and reelected in the midterm elections, and then beyond that, trying to get Obama reelected when he runs again in a couple of years. And that seems to be blinding him to the larger issue, which is how is Obama going to be viewed by history? And isn't it important, even in short-term political terms, for him to protect his base, if you will, by following through on the promises that he's made, the very promises that got him elected? And as you well know, the promise to take action on climate change was at the top of his list. Now, that's not to say they haven't done anything. The Department of Energy has been active. They boosted fuel efficiency standards. They've done a lot in the EPA, moving toward regulation of stationary sources of CO2 emissions. So there has been activity in the White House and in the executive branch writ large. But on the single most important thing, pricing carbon, capping and limiting carbon pollution, they have not been as strong as you or I or anyone else in the community would have hoped. And that seems to be laid at the feet of Rahm Emanuel, David Axelrod, and others. According to my reporting, which is exhaustive, those were the voices saying, we don't have the votes to win this now. Let's go do something else instead. And in fact, when Rahm Emanuel would sit down with not just environmental leaders, but also corporate leaders who were in favor of a cap, he would say, okay, we're all for a cap, but if the votes aren't there, we're going to move on. Success breeds success, and we want to win. And if we can't win this, we'll go win something else. And it was all very situational, and yeah, I want to do this, but not so bad that I'm willing to risk a loss that might erode Obama's political capital. So he saw it as a hill that was a little too steep and a little too deep, hard defended for him to take. And again, I think that much is clear, but it's also clear that Barack Obama is the president of the United States, and if he had said a year ago, no, we're going to bring this bill to the floor, it would have happened. And if he says now we need a cap on power plant emissions in this bill or it's a fake bill and I'll veto it, that'll be a clear statement too. But so far he hasn't said that. So we can bring it back to the president's.
A lot of political capital and bandwidth and time and energy was taken up by the health care bill. Do you think it was a mistake to take up climate change after that? And the, one of the key differences is, and this is the key missing piece, is there was a lot of public pressure to reform health care. Where is the broad public pressure to, you know, cap carbon emissions? Where is the American public not seeing the need to do something urgently on this issue? And isn't that part of the problem, that we still don't have movement with enough muscle behind this climate issue, and despite, you know, the best efforts on the part of green groups and activists and authors like yourself and people like myself who have been trying to bring attention through mainstream media broadcast, there still seems to be a disconnect.
It is part of the problem. There's no question about it, Betsy. The one thing to keep in mind is that we do have majorities in this country calling for climate action. So it is majority opinion that we should do something about this. At the same time, it is not a priority for most Americans. And part of the reason is just the very nature of the problem. It is a difficult and sometimes seems abstract and sometimes seems in the future, even though the impacts are happening now and we have to take action now, as you well know. It's also true that it has been the business of a well-funded group of what I call professional deniers to sow doubt and confusion about whether this problem was real. They've been very effective, and their arguments have been taken up virus-like by a whole panoply of right-wing bloggers and armchair scientists who are out there sowing confusion every chance they get as well. So we need to cut through this. I think most Americans know in their bones that this is happening, and we have to do something about it. It has to get beyond the environmental community, Betsy. There's no question about it.
Exactly.
The environmental community is necessary but not sufficient to get this done. And frankly, that's why I wrote a book that I hope would appeal to people who don't read a lot of climate books. I want all the people interested in climate to read it as well. But I wanted a book that was a page-turner, that it was character-driven, that read like a novel, and that personalized this issue for people who might not have given it a lot of thought and who brought them inside the campaign to understand the passions of the people who get it and the lies of the people who don't. So that's what the climate war is all about. And I'm very heartened every time I get a tweet or an email from somebody who's read the book, put it down, and written a letter to Obama or written a letter to his or her senator. And I'm getting a lot of those calls, emails, letters, and that makes me happy, especially when they come from people who hadn't been active before.
And that's why it's so terrific that, you know, as someone who works for Bloomberg, very mainstream business publications, you've written this book, and that's why I was on CBS and tried to hang on to Air America and just finished this crazy contest trying to get a green show on Oprah's new television network, because that's exactly the kind of mainstream platform we need to elevate these discussions to. I don't know about you, but I'm not interested in talking to the choir. You know, my green friends listen to the green shows, but they already know this. It's really necessary, essential to get this out to the masses, and it shouldn't be so difficult. And part of the problem is, as you said, you know, the professional deniers, you know, are on Sean Hannity a lot and Rush Limbaugh, and those right-wing conservative extremist talk show hosts dominate the radio airwaves. 90% of all talk radio is conservative, and those people, again, I don't know where, you know, they think their children and grandchildren are going to thrive in the future, but they are, you know, the mouthpieces for these deniers. And then where do we have, you know, the other side? And they're American, not there. And it shouldn't be political. I mean, this is what's so, you know, mind-boggling and frustrating is we're playing politics with the planet. And the fate of the planet is at stake, as you said, as well as trillions of dollars. And you called this climate war an American civil war, which I found very interesting.
Well, you know, there's this huge gulf between what the science tells us we need to do and what our politics tells us is possible. So everybody in my book who's trying to get this done understands that our political system is fundamentally broken and dysfunctional. But they're heroic because they're in there trying to make it work. Anyway, I've been going around the country talking about the book, and almost everywhere I go, someone stands up and says, well, the political system is so messed up, How can you spend your time covering it, writing about it, and why do these people bother? And I say, well, you know, it's the only political system we have. What is our alternative? We have to get this thing working because we don't have time to wait for some perfect moment when our political system has been reformed and all of the obstacles go away. We've got to get going now. That's
right.
Why I'm so heartened when business people come forward and say, let's do this. That's why I spend time talking about an organization called USCAP, which is a coalition of environmental and business organizations, Fortune 500 companies, who have been calling for a mandatory cap, controversial in parts of the environmental community, because they were willing to give carbon allowances to companies who then have to pass on the value of those to their customers. But that was seen as a giveaway to polluters. In my view, it was a necessary compromise in order to get things going in this issue. My view on the compromise is that if they don't undermine the environmental integrity of the bill, they should be on the table. There are places that I won't go, and certainly places where all of the mainstream environmental groups that are trying to get this done won't go. And let me hasten to add that the further left groups that are outside the system and screaming for more and better now play an incredibly important role too, Betsy, and I'm totally in favor of them. As I said, I kind of fell in love with the kids who are chaining themselves to bulldozers, saying we're not going to wait for somebody else to get this done. We're going to take it upon ourselves. And they have this great philosophy that you know, we may not be able to change the course of events because the forces arrayed against us are so powerful, but at least it's good for our souls to try. And, you know, as one of them told me, you know, every pebble you drop into the lake makes a ripple, and there's no telling where those ripples go. And we're going to keep dropping pebbles in until we make a difference or die trying.
And that's why I've loved interviewing those passionate activists for 13 years, because they've been marginalized by society, and they are fighting for the greater good. And you may not agree with everything they say, but, you know, their voices should be heard, because too much of the other is dominating, you know, in mainstream media. You talk about the need to compromise. You say we might need to really include nuclear as part of the mix.
Well, I do. I mean, and you're talking to somebody who has helped shut down a nuclear power plant with a cover story I wrote for Time magazine in 1995. I have not been a fan or a defender of nuclear power, but when you look at the task in front of us to decarbonize our energy system and the fact that 20% of existing electricity comes from nuclear power, I don't think you can take nuclear off the table. Nuclear has to compete from a price basis against other forms of energy, and I think if it can compete, then it deserves to be part of the mix. I think the waste issue is solvable. I know that there are people who are listening who will disagree with me. I think that everybody involved in this debate is going to have to climb down from some deeply held beliefs before we're done. And I personally believe that that's one of them. There are people who disagree with me, and I respect them. But I'm not saying that nuclear should receive so many subsidies that it doesn't have to compete against other forms of power. I'm saying that it deserves a chance to fight to be part of the mix. And I think that was the powerful thing about the idea of putting a price on carbon. It gives advantage to every clean form of energy simultaneously, and it doesn't pick winners and losers.
I saw a great quote in a little clip from the Commonwealth Club presentation in San Francisco a few weeks ago on your website, and you said, I'm in favor of a climate bill that doesn't get so diluted. I want a bill that the atmosphere will actually notice. And I laughed out loud and scared my dog. Because,
isn't it?
that's
the bottom line, and that's why it's so difficult now, because we can't get where we need to go in one fell swoop. We have to get started with a bill that is frankly going to be too weak. It's not going to be good enough. But if the framework is sound, we can ratchet down our targets over time and get where we need to go. I have a bias toward action. I have a bias toward getting started. That doesn't mean a fake bill that gets nothing done. That means a real bill that puts a real price on carbon. If we have to start it inside the power community, the power utility sector, so be it. But let's get started. Let's not wait because we're arguing over whether a bill is good enough or whether a tax might be better than a cap. While the left has been arguing over the particulars of what to do, the right has been totally unified. And as you say, they've had a huge megaphone, and they have demonized the whole idea of climate action in the country at large. And as one of the villains of the book, Myronnie Bell, said to me, we need to keep the heartland, we being the deniers. If we can keep the heartland, we'll win. And so far, they have kept the heartland. I think that the war's not over, and I'm still hopeful that we can win.
And yet there's no heartland on a dead planet.
Absolutely. The denier position is predicated on the illusion that this is not a catastrophic problem.
And isn't the heartland having, like, killer record tornadoes and hurricanes and extreme weather events?
They are, and I think over time that will help bring people around. I think the fact that I'm here in New York City and it's somewhere around 101 or 102 today helps, too. And people always hasten to say, well, no single weather event can be tied directly to global warming. And, of course, that's true. But as Dr. Jim Hansen taught us long ago, what climate change does is load the dice. So it comes up hotter, wetter, and more catastrophically violent more often.
And as Al Gore just showed us last week with his slides, January through May were among the hottest months ever for not only global temperatures but ocean temperatures, and something like 8 or 9 of the last 10 years have been the warmest. So even though the East Coast, you know, had this extreme cold, snowy winter, and isn't that part of it? It's about extremes. So the hot areas get hotter, the cold get colder. You know, more precipitation in the atmosphere leads to, you know, more extreme rain and snow, which is, you know, dictated by temperatures, ocean temperatures and atmospheric temperatures. So it seems like we still have to make those connections, even though they should be obvious by now.
Well, I think we do. And if you step back, we've come a long way because, look, we had a president for 8 years who was denying that this was a problem. George W. Bush was as bad as Rush Limbaugh or Glenn Beck in terms of having a huge megaphone that confused people. Now we've got a president who has a huge megaphone and knows that the issue is real, yet he hasn't used it as effectively as he might. So we're calling on Obama to turn up the megaphone and explain to people in a sustained way what's happening and why it matters. The climate threat is part of the message. Another part of the message is the need to transition to clean energy before China completely dominates that market. The Chinese are spending $9 billion a month on clean energy. We can't compete with that kind of centralized planned economy. We need a market to compete, and that's why it's so important to price carbon through a mandatory declining cap.
And what do you say to skeptics who might otherwise be open to say, what does it matter what the U.S. does? Because China is growing so fast in terms of population and their hunger for vehicles that their CO2 is going to overwhelm ours. And yes, they are certainly beginning to take the lead in terms of not only fuel efficiency standards being stronger than ours, but also, you know, the transition to more clean technology, hopefully, you know, leapfrogging over some of our mistakes. But it's true that they are growing at a rapid rate that is frightening when you look at just CO2 alone, let alone how it affects global economy and politics.
It's true, and it's also true that we had a 100-year head start on prosperity through burning fossil fuels. So we need to go first if we're going to expect China to go at all. I respond to that question by quoting a Republican senator, John Warner of Virginia, now retired, who says, you know, our inaction allows China and India to hide behind our skirts. And we can't do that anymore. We have to lead. We have to step up. And now, since Warner articulated that, it's become even clearer that it's not only about going first because of the moral leadership that's necessary. It's also about going first so that we can stay in the game in the great energy race.
That's right.
We need to do that. We're getting skunked by the Chinese. And the only way we can compete is if we go first and cap carbon and create a market that can bring the billions and billions of dollars now on the sidelines into the market for clean energy.
And I think that is the most hopeful argument, because American, you know, ingenuity and innovation and competitive spirit is as embedded in our DNA as consuming and over-consuming.
Well, you're absolutely right, and that's why it's so tragic. You know, I have in my book are leaders of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers, groups that have been responsible for so much dynamism and innovation in American history. And I am not an anti-business guy. As you said, I'm the deputy editor of Business Week magazine. I believe that business needs to be part of the solution and that it must be part of the solution if we're going to get this done. So it pains me when I see these groups that have been so dynamic at times in our past now being fearful, conservative in the sense of not taking any risks, not being able to embrace the future, not being able to step up and meet the road as it's heading toward the horizon.
Eric, before I let you go, one last question. What should we be watching for in these next few days and weeks in regards to the climate bill? And if there is no cap on anything other than the utility sector, power sector, are we screwed?
Well, the worst case is that there's no cap at all, not even on the utility sector. There will be some other provisions in the energy bill that will help a little bit. There will be a renewable energy standard that says that utilities need to get a certain percentage of their power from alternative energy sources. There will be other mandates and subsidies that will help. So it won't be a total loss, but we've had a bunch of those kind of bills over the years, and they haven't gotten the job done. So we do need a cap. What do we look for in the next few days? We look for the president to lead. We look for the president to stand up and articulate exactly what he thinks ought to be in this bill. He hasn't done it so far. Frankly, I was shocked that he didn't do it in the Oval Office speech.
Yeah.
Hasn't done it since. It's time for Barack Obama to stop what I call the stealth strategy and become vocal, specific, and as persuasive as we know he can be. He's a terrific communicator. Time for him to start communicating.
Eric Pooley, thank you for what you're doing to communicate the urgency of climate change. I highly recommend this book, Climate War. I haven't even read it yet, but I hope it's on its way to my mailbox. Really,
indeed,
thank you
is.
For your work. Thank you so much. And
thanks,
I'm going to tell everybody I know to read this book. I'm going to continue to promote it on the show. And we'll be in touch. We'll be following this closely. And hopefully we'll have some good news to report in a few weeks.
Thanks again.
That's Eric Pooley. He is the deputy editor of the Bloomberg Business Week magazine, also the author of The Climate War, and he's got a lot of credibility, very fair-minded, just a must-read, and I couldn't encourage you more to read it. And the only other book I also highly recommend is going to be the topic of our next interview, and that is with Frances Moore LePay, one of my sheroes. She, of course, wrote Diet for a Small Planet, I believe it was called. I read it a long time ago. And most recently, Get a Grip 2, in fact. Why are we creating a world that nobody wants? You want to hear the answer to that? I certainly do. And what we can do to change that. And this show is about change, about turning it around, right after these messages. You're listening to The Green Front. I'm Betsy Rosenberg. Stay with us.